females are quite fearful of us. They see us on stage, we've got, you know, zombie takeout in our trousers. I mean, it's really quite frightening. What's up? Welcome to episode 63 of Zombie
Taken, Wine and Dine,
the B-movie and cult movie podcast. I'm Uncle John.
And I'm Scotto.
And we don't have any listeners submitted this week, so let's just jump right into the movie. Probably, I'm going to say the best movie we've done so far. We're on a very short list, top three, maybe.
Yeah.
It is from 1984. This is Spinal Tap. And that leads us to Scotto's impromptu plot summary, sponsored by The Electric Banana. Don't look for it. It's not there anymore.
Wow. This one's not easy to do, is it?
Really? I think it would be easy.
Well, yeah, I guess we can generalize here. We have a hack director, Marty mm-hmm. DeBurgi, and he's following a band trying to make a comeback. It's the movie Anvil.
Yeah.
How did Anvil live this life years after this? Pretty much they were doing this the same time Anvil was starting out.
Mm-hmm.
Did they see this movie and say, that's us in 20 years? yeah. So anyway, he's following them on their big comeback North America tour, the band Spinal Tap, of course. And, well, the usual rock and roll cliches are all explored throughout the movie, and hilarity ensues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess it was easier than I thought.
Now, you mentioned Anvil. It turns out this movie actually cuts a bit too close to home for several musicians. Jimmy Page, Robert Plant, Dee Snider, and Ozzy Osbourne have all reported that, like Spinal Tap, they've gotten lost backstage.
Well, that was, I think, I heard Harry Shearer being interviewed on Opie and Anthony, and he was told by the members of Van Halen that they were watching this and busting a gut at it, everyone with the exception of Eddie Van Halen, who was dead quiet until he erupted and said, shut the fuck up, this isn't funny.
It was his life.
But yeah, it's been too long since I've seen this movie,
mm-hmm.
but it is just amazing how funny all the jokes still are.
Oh, yeah.
Even when you know it's coming. I mean, when you know they're going to be lost on their way to the show and they're still not going to quite get it,
mm-hmm.
it's still funny.
Oh, yeah. And the old guy giving them directions to the stage and then kind of forgetting the directions, which makes them that much more confused.
Right.
We should explain for those who haven't seen the movie. Well, first, you should be ashamed of yourself.
Right.
Secondly, there's a scene where they're about to go on stage at some arena, and they go in circles about four times, have with no clue of where they are, until they run into this security guard, and he kind of gives them sketchy directions, and they're still lost. Eventually, they get there, of course. But now, you mentioned how funny it is. Turns out that Harry Shearer, Rob Reiner, Christopher Guest, and Michael McKean were given $10,000 to write the script. They took that money, made a 20-minute version of the film to better show what they could do with improvisation. Almost all of the dialogue was improvised.
Right, and this was, this is before the term Christopher Guest movie.
This is, I think, and we talked about this a bit last week off air, I think this is where Christopher Guest got it from.
Well, yeah. And I mean, they did this together.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a team effort. Reiner directed, sure. Mm-hmm. But writing, they were all, mm-hmm. All four of them were involved in the writing of the film. And they just did it as they went along.
Actually, it turns out that pretty much everybody improvised. The main four, Guest, Shearer, McKean, and Reiner, went to the Writers Guild hoping to give everyone in the movie writing credit, because they all wrote their own parts, I guess.
Well, come on,
They made the case that everybody deserved the writing credit.
But did they get that or?
No. The guild said no. We're keeping it as it is.
Because I mean, there's a difference between coming up with the bit about the pods.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, that's something you can't just improvise.
Right.
But and you know, just coming up with a few bits of dialogue here and there.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Some people more than others. Fran Drescher had enough time in this movie, which I was like, wow. Yeah, there were a bunch of people I just completely had forgotten were in this movie. And I said, she makes an appearance again. She's had some very good taste in parts in her early days.
And normally she irritates me. She doesn't in this one.
Oh, right. This one, UHF. I mean,
yeah, UHF also another example. Yeah.
I don't even see her on the IMDb. They don't even really have her listed very prominently in it.
But also, another surprise for me was Paul Schaefer. Because, like I said, it's been ages since I've seen it. He can actually act.
Yeah, you know, he was a bit of a surprise in there, too. You know, him, Bruno Kirby. Mm-hmm. I mean, just people I was like, wow.
That's the limo driver. I could not think of his name.
Yeah, Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
I mean, none of these people were anybody when they did this. Mm-hmm. You have to remember that. They say Dana Carvey was the other mime waiter.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I completely didn't recognize
him. I didn't even notice him.
Yeah, he's the one that Billy Crystal's yelling at.
Oh, okay.
Who, I mean, if you weren't aware that it was improvised, what was it? There's no mime like the some bad joke Billy Crystal made.
Yeah.
Like, if you didn't know it was improvised, you know, you knew then.
Mm-hmm.
Howard Hessman, I think, is the only person I remember in this, actually.
I remembered Schaefer. I did not remember his part. And the other person I remember, decided from obviously the main cast, was, of course, Fred Willard.
I was not aware Fred Willard was in this.
Really?
Yeah.
I think if I have one complaint, it's that there's not enough Fred Willard in the movie.
Well, you can say that about any movie.
Well, true. I think that's what Christopher Guest took away, because his whole style is borrowed from this movie.
I would think Gone with the Wind and Casablanca would have been halfway decent films if they had some Fred Willard in it.
Wow. But, you know, Christopher Guest took his whole pretty much movie-making style from this movie, I think.
Well, yeah.
It's safe to say.
And they're only missing Diane Wiest and Eugene Levy, and this would have been a Christopher Guest.
Exactly. But I think that's the one thing he changed and improved upon. It is more Fred Willard.
Yeah. You can never have too much Fred Willard in a movie.
Now, it's what got me was, it's surprising that this happened before Behind the Music. Because that whole series just vindicated this movie.
Well, yeah. It's amazing how far ahead of its time this movie was.
Yeah.
That they did chart the career of Anvil before Anvil came along.
And it was also really prophetic about old bands. This happened with a lot of hair bands in the 80s. They became, you know, after their time here had passed, they became very popular in Japan.
Right.
And that's what happens to Spinal Tap. They become, the band splits up, gets back together because they've suddenly become popular in Japan.
Spoiler alert, John.
Oh. Again, if you haven't seen it, you should be ashamed of yourself. There are no spoilers.
All right.
You know, how many... You know, I know Quiet Riot was big. The Scorpions, they were all huge in Japan in the 90s. And, you know, somehow they knew that was going to happen.
What about Belgium, man?
Mm.
Ooh, is that too... Is a singles reference too obscure?
It's been way too far since... Way too long since I've seen that movie.
I guess so.
Way over my head.
All right. But it was a scene with Pearl Jam. You have to remember the scene with Pearl Jam in singles.
Vaguely.
Those are the only scenes in that movie worth watching. Anyway.
No, there's one thing, there's one joke I think is lost on a lot of people. Being a music geek, I loved.
What's that?
Polymer Records.
Right.
The record company is Polymer.
Right.
Which is a complete parody of PolyGram Records.
Okay, right. You know, I just assumed they were using the actual name of the record company.
No, there's Polygram and Polydor. I don't think Polydor's been around for long enough. I know Polygram was around when they made this movie.
Right, when they made the movie, it was a big record company.
Yeah, so it was a whole...
But, you know.
It was a parody of Polygram, which I got a kick out of. Also, my favorite scene, and it's a small thing that I think only a guitar player can appreciate.
What's that?
The guitar that he can't play.
Don't even look at it.
It's this seafoam green Fender. You only see the headstock. It's the only reason I know it's a Fender. I can't even name what model it is. But, it's still got the tag on it. You're not allowed to touch it. I've had similar experiences. A few summers ago, I had an opportunity to play a $5,000 or $6,000 D'Angelico New Yorker. The premier jazz guitar. I was afraid to touch it. I initially turned it down. I said, no, I don't want to play it because I can't touch it. It's too... And part of it was, it's not mine. I didn't want to damage it.
All right.
Part of it was, I'm just not worthy. and it speaks to a lot of musicians, particularly guitar players, have a tendency to, for lack of a better word, fetishize our instruments. And I don't mean that in a sexual way.
Sure, of course not.
But, they take on more, they become more than just tools.
Nothing phallic about a guitar.
Well, yeah. Okay, perhaps it is in a bit of a sexual way, too. But they become more than just a tool, a means to an end. There was several years ago, I went to Sam Ash to buy a new amplifier. I spent my student loan refund, reimbursement on an amplifier. Walked into Sam Ash, wall, I'm going to say 30 feet tall, 50 foot wide, all high-end guitars. It was simultaneously a sexual and religious experience.
Well, there's a lot of material in this movie that, it's esoteric, in a sense. It is just for the music geek.
Yeah.
But it really... You can catch it on. I mean, I'm not really a music geek myself, and I could catch some of the jokes where
he's
playing the classical music.
Right, and, right. Wish I could remember the name of that piece.
It was in the trivia somewhere, but what's this called? Well, after he's telling it's a tribute to Mozart and Brahms.
That was the original. I'm talking about the guitar solo. That was the classical piece.
Oh. Oh, I was talking about the part he was playing on the piano.
Piano, then Lick My Love Pump.
Lick My Love Pump of this beautiful piece of music he's worked on. Oh, you're talking about the classical guitar solo that he did.
This famous piece that I'm completely blanking on the name of, that's in the middle of this, they call themselves heavy metal. They're not really heavy metal. But, this heavy piece, and all of a sudden he's playing this classical solo.
That's the thing, though. Metal bands... Well, what was metal when they were starting in the 60s?
They're metal, exactly. They're metal in image, in style. They're not metal musically.
And then what was happening to metal bands when the 80s came along, where they had to throw in the keyboard player for some inexplicable reason just to, look modern, to look too dated.
Which was several years after this movie. The hair metal era in the mid-80s.
I imagine somebody had to have been doing that, to come up with the idea to parody it.
Right, right.
I just can't think of who.
Well, I mean, there was a lot that they kind of took from Prague as well.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
And that's where you get
Stonehenge,
the keeper part.
Of course.
Yeah.
We will ruin if you haven't seen it.
Yeah. I think that's a half of what they were parodying was metal, and a lot of what they were parodying was kind of the bombastic, pretentious prog stuff, like Stonehenge and.
The thing with the pods, I'd always related to, the old Genesis.
Exactly, I knew that had to be a Genesis nod.
Where he couldn't even get the microphone to his face, sing into it. But, I think it was actually a lot, it was actually not as bad a disaster as the Genesis thing, just for the one guy's pot not to open.
Right.
But he's still playing the bass along with it.
Incidentally, it should be noted that they all played their own instruments in the movie.
Yeah, well, they are music lovers, all of them. I mean, that's why they came back and did A Mighty Wind later on.
Right, right. And they've done a few Spinal Tap albums since the movie.
Well, right. I think when we were talking about this, you would assume that this was done closer to our time at WOCC because they had, you know, remember they had the Spinal Tap album,
Break Like the Wind came out at that point. I knew the movie was much older. I'd seen it years before then. One thing that they parodied that I was really kind of surprised that they had the balls to do in 84.
What?
Was the John Lennon reference.
Oh, what was the John Lennon reference?
Well, the whole Yoko riff with David St. Hubbin's girlfriend.
Okay, yeah.
And he basically turned into John Lennon.
Yeah.
You know, they just had to throw, you know, a Benny reference and it would have been complete. This was 4 years after his death, so I'm a little surprised that they had the balls to do that.
They didn't make it all that obvious that it was Lennon. I mean, you could also say it was Paul McCartney, but, you know.
Well, Hubbins was clearly Lennon in that case. You know, he was the one with the girlfriend who tore the band apart.
Yeah.
You know, Nigel was McCartney.
Yeah, did you see how what they got Nigel's name from?
Yes. It was a reference to Eric Clapton. I have that in my notes.
It was like a boring name.
It's a joke on Eric Clapton, derived from dull name and location in London. Eric became Nigel, and Clapton Pond became Tufnell Park, or just shortened to Tufnell.
So, I mean, Guest and McKean, you can completely buy in their roles.
Oh, absolutely.
I think Scheer, though, if it wasn't for the facial hair and the hair, you know, the wig itself, you know, Scheer, I don't know if I would have bought.
That was the great thing about his part, because there's always that, and it's frequently the bass player, that quiet intellectual in the band, in these insane bands. He was that guy. He was the rationalist. So a couple of years ago, I saw an interview on Headbangers Ball with Steve Harris from Iron Maiden, bass player from Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're this, you know, loud, you know, they've got a loud metal band. They've got Eddie, the giant zombie mascot. Steve Harris shows up, you know, very well-dressed, tweed jacket with the elbow pads, very soft-spoken.
My God, you're right. John Paul Jones, Mike Rutherford.
Bass players. He's the bass player.
That does do it.
It's a thing.
Yeah, I guess I never noticed that before.
Because bass players are the ones who don't get noticed, so you don't get the egos with bass players.
Ah. But how many bands have gone through the whole drummer thing? I mean, I know there were bands that were like, okay, another drummer.
I think specifically that was a riff on Keith Moon and John Bonham.
That is true. The drummer did buy it in a lot of good bands.
Yeah, and specifically Bonham, who you know, choked on his own vomit.
Yeah.
And they referenced their first drummer choked on someone else's vomit.
That's what I was thinking of for the intro, too. Choked on someone else's zombie takeout. Oh well.
That would have been good. But so the whole drummer thing, it was a reference to specifically those two. And I'm sure there's other examples. They just, you know, to use the cliche, turned it up to 11. specifically about the drummers, they have four different drummers throughout the film.
And wasn't Ed Begley Jr. hilarious?
Oh, yes.
2 seconds there.
The names, though, John Stumpy Pepys, Eric Stumpy Joe Childs, Mick Shrimpton, and Joe Mama Besser. These names were inspired by the four different men who played the role of the third Stooge in the Three Stooges films. Curly Howard, Curly Joe DeRita, Shemp Howard, and Joe Besser. And the Joe Besser thing was right up, in, you know, obvious.
Are you saying that we're bringing 2010 full circle to a close with fake Shemps?
Yes.
That's awesome. We should just end the show right now. No, was it just me? The eerie resemblance, though, in this Michael McKean. Who do you think he resembles more, Mustaine or Hetfield?
Oh, Mustaine! I'm definitely seeing Mustaine.
I was thinking that. I mean,
I'm seeing Mustaine and maybe a little David Lee Roth.
It's the red hair.
That
really drives the Mustaine.
Yeah.
Look home, but this is before. Well, I guess not before, but
a couple years before they got big.
That's true.
Nobody really knew who Megadeth was at this point. I think he might have still been in Metallica at this point.
No, he was out of Metallica. Okay. He wasn't in Metallica long.
All right. But nobody really knew who they were in 84.
He didn't last the bus ride.
That's right. That's French.
They wrote some stuff together, and then they're like, oh, let's go record. And then, we got to get rid of this guy. But just the appearance, and of course it wasn't intentional.
Right,
it just, he just happened to look like him back then.
Yeah, yeah.
With the red wig.
And it turns out there were a couple of cases of people thinking that they were a real band. After the film opened, several people approached director Rob Reiner, telling him they loved the film, but he should have chosen a better-known band. And the home video version, the Hellhole video, has a disclaimer inserted at the end saying that they don't actually exist.
And there's no Easter Bunny either.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was looking for in terms of the band members. I just found it in my notes.
What's up?
It is revealed that 37 different people have been in the band over the years.
Right.
Minus the two original members, one keyboard player, and the original and current bass players, this implies that they've been through 32 different drummers who have inexplicably died.
Well, if you remember when they did the reunion, when they first got back together, I'm trying to remember what year that might have been. It might have been 90 or 89 or something like that. That they were having auditions for drummers, and it was like a pretty public thing, and they had all of these real drummers showing
up. Yeah.
Like the drummer from the Bengals showed up. Mick Fleetwood showed up. I mean, there was like all this crazy thing, and of course Mick Fleetwood was wearing a mask, so they're doing this show and you had no idea who it was. Mm-hmm. Until the very end of the show, it was like a beekeeper suit or something. And he like whips the mask off at the end of the set, and it's Mick Fleetwood, and everyone just goes nuts.
Nice. Now, this film has actually had some impact in the real world.
Of course.
A popular bar and music venue on the east side of Milwaukee has changed its name to Shank Hall after the fictitious Milwaukee location that the band played in.
And next time I'm there, I'm so looking forward.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Just like if I'm ever up in Ontario. Mm-hmm. I forget the name of the place now. From Jesus Christ, Vampire Slayer. So how much... what other trivia do we have?
Rob Reiner was originally going to be one of the band members. He ended up directing. This is why he was directing. Because Harry Shearer said he didn't look good in spandex.
And he was right.
Well, I wouldn't want to see him in spandex.
Yeah, I don't know if I wanted to see those guys in spandex.
Of course not.
I was like, that's my one strike against this, I think. Too many crotch shots and ass shots.
But it fits the style. It fits what they're parodying.
Of course
parodying,
it does.
You know?
Of
they
course
couldn't have
it
not
does.
Done that.
But yeah, this is, you know, strict no man ass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's better than a Foley.
Yes. No one said anything about the Foley. So, are we up to brains? Are we ready to turn this show up to 11 and close out?
Yeah, on to brains. Like I said, I had that one little issue with, I think there should have been more Fred Willard.
Yeah.
But beyond that, it's pretty much flawless. It is a masterpiece. In fact, one little bit of trivia just to, not to roll back too far, but...
All right.
In 2002, This Is Spinal Tap was deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant by the Library of Congress. And was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Library, or Registry.
You know, because one of the things, I mean, we were talking back and forth about this off the air last week, mm-hmm. and, you know, no one saw this in the movie theater.
No. It is the definition of a cult film. It bombed
right.
theaters.
It, they claim that it cost about $2.5 million to make, mm-hmm. which where that went, I don't know. It only made...
The pods.
Yeah, it just... barely made 200,000. Well, it didn't clear 200,000 worldwide. So yeah, it lost $2 million at the box office. So, you know.
But then it came, it came out on home video and exploded.
Well, right. It made its way through home video And it's, of course, made, it's been re-released since, and, you know, it's made millions since. Mm-hmm. But as far as, you know, as people actually have gone to see this in the theater, yeah, yeah. Who knows? I mean, I don't think it had that much of a release.
No, no. I'm surprised they haven't done midnight showings.
That's true.
At least none that I've heard of.
That's true. I mean, if I ever get a movie theater again, mm-hmm. this would be a film I would put up on a midnight showing. Not every week, of course, but, you know.
So back to Brains.
And back to Brains.
Like I said, it'd be much flawless. It is a masterpiece. I got to go 5, of course.
Yeah, there's no suspense here. I'd watch this movie right now again with no problem, honestly. You know, one thing when I was talking about Dog Soldiers and, like, you know, you can enjoy a movie, but you don't necessarily need to watch it again. And that was a 4.
Yeah, right, right.
This one, but the whole thing about my being able to scan on mine and not it started the movie again from the beginning, I watched the first 20 minutes over again with no problem. It was a conversation we had off air where I had to, like, I was going back for a line to get the exact quote, and instead it went all the way to the beginning and I couldn't scan. So I just watched the whole movie again for that 20 minutes. So yeah, if there are no 5 Brain movies.
Yeah. I almost want to go 6 on this one.
Well, you know, in the IMDb page, the stars go up to 11.
Do they?
Yes, they do.
That's nice.
Look at the stars. It's 8 out of 11 stars.
I may have to create a 6 Brain. Do we want to go 6? I can create the graphic.
You know what? In honor, yeah. Let's go 6.
We'll go 6 on this one.
But we'll only do this for Spinal Tap because...
Of course. After this, it's 5. The limit is 5 after this. So, what have we learned?
Be careful when you're going through the airport.
And I learned that Tyree Shearer is a surprisingly good bass player.
You know,
yeah, that airport thing, I'm waiting for someone to pull that on the TSA.
I'm surprised you didn't mention the Zeppelin reference in this movie.
Well, it was a little obvious.
He's playing the guitar. The
violin, yeah.
Was it a violin? I thought it was a ukulele.
No, it was a violin because Paige used a violin bow.
Okay, used the bow. Honestly, it might have been funnier if it was a ukulele.
Yeah, but it was said to be a direct reference to Paige.
Well, of course.
So go to zombietakeout.com, check out the album art, the episode description, the episode itself, of course, links to Wikipedia and Facebook, and IMDb, and our Facebook link, and our voicemail. You can leave us a voicemail. The number is 414-368-ZT01, or for the alphanumerically challenged, that's 414-368-9861. And you can also, and I don't mention this enough, you can email us, zombietakeout@gmail.com.
Email? Sending us electronic mail?
We haven't mentioned the email address in a while, so I thought it was time.
And by the way, if you are sending that voicemail, remember that a standard long-distance charge is applied.
Yes, yes.
As if you were calling
from Milwaukee. You will always be calling from Milwaukee.
Yes, we cannot say that enough.
So until next week when we will be reviewing...
Well, next
year.
Oh,
yes, yes. We're taking the next few weeks off.
You see, this was us turning it up to 11.
To end the year.
Yes. Because, you know, that is next year, right?
Yes, yes. I didn't think about that.
This millennium goes up to 11.
It's going to be, you know, 99 all over again. People are going to be referencing it left and right.
You really think so? Because I think so far I'm the only person that's been...
I think once the year happens, it's going to be referenced constantly.
Then again, they didn't start like back in May like I was, I guess. I don't know.
So, in 4 weeks, when we will be reviewing Tron... Until then, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.
Listen.
How much is it?
Just listen for a minute. Mr. Stein, listen to it.
I'm not hearing anything.
You would, though, if it were playing, because it really, it's famous for its sustain. I mean, you can just hold it.
Well, I mean, so you'd have to put...
You can go and have a bite. No, you'd still be hearing that one.
Yeah.
It was simultaneously a sexual and religious experience.